You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
This morning I've been asked to talk to you on the question of, did Jesus have female disciples? And as AJ mentioned a couple of years ago, I wrote a book called Jesus Through the Eyes of Women, where I'm looking specifically in that book at the stories that we hear about Jesus' interaction with women in the Gospels. And in the course of writing that book, I had this moment where I thought, Jesus had female disciples in the fullest sense. And I felt almost transgressive when I realized that. I know that's kind of a weird thing to confess. I texted my friend Rachel and I was like, I think I've come to the conclusion that Jesus had female disciples in the fullest sense. She was like, yeah, obviously. And I was like, okay, it's just me then. But if you, like me, are a little bit late to this party, then we're going to spend a bit of time this morning looking at the various ways in which Jesus engaged with women, and in particular at this question of whether Jesus had female disciples. Now, some confusion has arisen because Jesus had 12 male apostles who were chosen for a specific task. Just as God's people in the Old Testament had 12 tribes. So Jesus' 12 chosen apostles were almost like a relaunch for God's people. And each of these was a Jewish man. And sometimes in the Gospels, the Gospel authors will talk about the disciples, meaning the 12. And other times, the Gospel authors will talk about the disciples, meaning the larger group of people, men and women, who walked around with Jesus, went everywhere he did, watched everything he did, listened to everything he said. That the formal job of a disciple in those days was to learn their rabbi's teaching. And Jesus had this crew of disciples who would travel around with him, both male and female. So we're going to spend a little bit of time this morning thinking about the unique relationships and roles and ways that Jesus engaged with women in the Gospels. And we're going to think about them under five headings: prophecy, discipleship, healing, forgiveness, and life. So number one, prophecy. My son, my third born, and pray God, my last child, is named Luke. And I gave him that name because Luke, depending on the day, is or is not my favorite gospel. So it's either Luke or John. And Luke is just a better name than John. So I went for Luke. And one of the reasons, no offense to all the Johns in this room, I'm sure there are many. One of the reasons I went for Luke in particular is because Luke's gospel, even beyond all the other gospels, tells us many, many stories about Jesus' interactions with women. And in the first few chapters of Luke's gospel, we get to see how God spoke through women in prophetic ways around Jesus' birth. So you may remember at the beginning of Luke's gospel, we meet this couple, Elizabeth and Zechariah. Zechariah is a priest, and Elizabeth is his wife. And they are elderly, and they have not been able to have children. And then one day, Zechariah is in the temple, and an angel of the Lord appears to him and tells him that he's going to have a son. His son is going to be John the Baptist. And Zechariah is like a little bit unsure what to do with this. And he asked the angel Gabriel a question. And I kind of love Gabriel's response. Gabriel's like, listen up, buddy. He's like, I am Gabriel. I was sent from the Lord with this message for you. You're not going to be able to speak until this baby is born. As a kind of little bit of a slap on the wrist for your failure to like properly believe in this moment. And then we see Gabriel going to this little town of Nazareth. And we see him meeting with this young woman named Mary. Now, Mary has gone on to become possibly the most famous woman ever to have lived. But at the time, she was just a random teenager living in a backwater of a backwater of the Roman Empire. She had the most common name among Jewish women of her time and place. She was just another Mary. But then an angel came to her and told her that she was going to be the mother of God's one and only son. We know the prophecies about Jesus, the words spoken over Jesus by that angel because of Mary's testimony that Luke has written down. And we see Mary's faith as she receives these words from Gabriel. And if you read through Luke's gospel, you actually notice that Luke often parallels a man and a woman. So in this instance, Mary and Zechariah. And almost always when there's a contrast being drawn, the woman comes out best. No offense to the guys. But whereas Zechariah is sort of somewhat chided, Mary is only honored by the angel. But the situation that the angel places Mary in is actually a very difficult one. She's not married. She's engaged to this guy named Joseph, but they're not married yet. And for her to become pregnant without being married would have been deeply shameful and in fact quite dangerous for her. And for her to say, oh, don't worry, this child is actually the child of the covenant Lord, would only make things worse. You know, she's only adding blasphemy charges at that point to her seeming sexual immorality. Because whereas the Greek and Roman gods, who were believed in by many around the Jews at that time, they were perfectly accustomed to the idea that humans could be produced by sort of relationships between divine and human women. But for the Jews, this was completely anathema. The Jews believed in this one creator God, not many gods, one creator God who was utterly transcendent. The one whose name was so holy that Jewish people wouldn't even read it out when they came to it in the scriptures. This was a God who you couldn't see and live. And yet this is a God who claims that he is going to be the son, the father of Jesus's of Mary's son. So the message that Mary is bringing is completely scandalous to Jewish ears. And then we see what Mary does. She goes and visits her older relative, Elizabeth, who lives actually quite a long distance away from Nazareth. And famously, when Mary enters the house and Elizabeth hears her greeting, the little teeny-weeny John the Baptist in Elizabeth's womb leaps for joy. And Elizabeth, Luke tells us, is filled with the Holy Spirit. Now, in the Old Testament scriptures, people are sometimes filled with the Holy Spirit. But when that happens, it's because they're a prophet or because they're a king. There's like somebody very remarkable who's being filled with the Holy Spirit. And here Elizabeth is filled with the Holy Spirit. And she utters prophetic words. She recognizes who Jesus is even while he's in Mary's womb. Now, who am I that the mother of my Lord should be coming to visit me? And then Mary opens her mouth and utters one of the most extraordinary hymns of praise to God that we see in all of the scriptures. My soul magnifies the Lord. My spirit rejoices in God, my Savior. Mary goes on to explain all the ways in which Jesus will do some of the things we were talking about last night, how his ethical teaching is going to completely turn around the hierarchies of the day. How God is going to be throwing down the mighty from their thrones and how he's going to be lifting up the lowly. What Mary and Elizabeth are doing in that moment in Luke's gospel is prophecy. They're inspired by God to speak words of truth about who Jesus is. And then do you remember that moment when Mary and Joseph take the infant Jesus to the temple? And they meet with two special people in the temple. One is a man and the other is a woman. Anna, from the tribe of Asher, who Luke says is a prophetess. Now, we only have a little glimpse of Anna at the moment, how she comes in and she starts speaking prophetically over Jesus, explaining who he is. But she is the first person chronologically since the Old Testament prophets that the Bible explicitly recognizes as a prophet. You know, when John the Baptist isn't half old enough yet to be doing his prophetic work, Anna from the tribe of Asher is speaking prophecy. So as we look at women in the Gospels, we see these instances of women speaking as prophets. And what is a prophet's job? To speak God's words to God's people. So that's our first heading, prophecy. Number two is discipleship. Again, Luke's gospel is one of the treasure troves of finding more out about Jesus' female disciples. And there's this moment in Luke 8, at the beginning of Luke 8, when Luke gives us some particular names of people. Now, when we read through the gospel accounts, you'll often find that there are a lot of people who are just anonymous. You know, people who are healed or people who have different roles. We don't know what their names are. And then there are other people who are named. And you might wonder, well, you know, why are some people named and not others? When the gospel authors are telling us somebody's name, it's typically because they are pointing us to an eyewitness. And when Luke tells us about the people who traveled around with Jesus, he says the 12 went with him, and also many women who had been healed by Jesus from various diseases. And then he gives us some names. He says Mary Magdalene, Joanna, the wife of Chusa, Herod's household manager, and Susanna. Now, Mary Magdalene went on to become by far the most famous of Jesus' disciples, right? Because of the role, as we'll talk about in a minute, she played later in witnessing Jesus' resurrection. But all Luke tells us here is that Mary Magdalene, from whom 7 demons had been cast out. Now, we know very little about this Mary. As I said, get ready for lots of Marys, because it's the most common name among women of Jesus' time and place. And this is a Mary who's identified by the town where she comes from, Mary from Magdala. And we know that 7 demons have been cast out from her. And Mary had clearly lived a rough life. And she had gone from being somebody who was like a playground for demons to being a key player in the message of Jesus going out. So Mary Magdalene. Number two, Joanna, the wife of Chusa, Herod's household manager. Now, again, a sort of random detail, which if you're reading through Luke's gospel, you could be forgiven for just like letting that wash over you and not being curious about what that means. There's a fascinating British theologian and historian called Richard Borkham, who's written a number of brilliant books, including Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. Has anybody read that? Fantastic book. Where he's looking at the eyewitness accounts that we see kind of coming through to us in the gospels and how history functioned and how eyewitness accounts were used at that time. And he explains to us, he does quite a bit of research on what we can understand from that description, Joanna, the wife of Chusa, Herod's household manager. And what Richard Borkham says is, this is a woman who is actually quite high status. Her husband, we don't know if he was still alive at the time, had a very prominent role in King Herod's court, and Herod was the ruler of the region at the time. And she had left the court to go traipsing around the countryside with this Jewish rabbi and a bunch of male and female disciples. It would have caused quite a stir for Joanna to have left the court to do that. And then the third name we hear is Susanna. And because Susanna was actually a much less common name than either Mary or Joanna for Jewish women, she doesn't have a kind of descriptor, because many of the first readers of Luke would have probably been familiar with who she was. So these three women are given to us by Luke as particular eyewitnesses of Jesus' life and ministry in that time. And it's notable that Luke gives us three out of the larger group of women, because in legal cases, having three witnesses was always the best. So we have these three women who are witnessing Jesus' life and who are disciples in the sense that they're traveling around with Jesus from place to place. And then Luke tells us this other delightful story of two women in particular among Jesus' disciples, and actually in this case, not his itinerant disciples, not wandering around with him, but seemingly stayed in one place, Mary and Martha of Bethany. It's a very famous story, but I don't think it's always interpreted in quite the right way. So Mary and Martha, famously, they host Jesus at their house, and Martha is busy serving, and Mary is sitting at Jesus' feet. Now that's pretty technical language for where a disciple would be. You know, if somebody sits at the feet of somebody else, it's a formal way of describing them as a disciple. And so there's Mary sitting among the disciples at Jesus' feet. And Martha goes to Jesus and says, "Lord, like, tell my sister to get up and help." Like, who does she think she is sitting there with the disciples just like learning your stuff? She should be helping to serve. And Jesus says to her, Martha, you are troubled about many things. But Mary has chosen the better portion, and it will not be taken away from her. Jesus specifically defends Mary's right to sit at his feet as one of his disciples. And again, we'll see this as a theme, especially in Luke's gospel, of often when women in particular come under attack, typically from men, but in this instance, from the woman's own sister, Jesus will often step up to defend them. And here he's specifically defending Mary's right to be his disciple. But that's not the last time we hear from these extraordinary sisters, Mary and Martha. John's gospel tells us about them as well. It's one of my favorite chapters in the whole of the Bible, John chapter 11. At the beginning of the story, Mary and Martha call for Jesus because their brother Lazarus is sick. They say, "Lord, the one you love is sick." And Jesus' response to this message is very surprising. John tells us that Jesus loved Mary and Martha and Lazarus, and that he stayed where he was and didn't come. It doesn't make any sense. It would make sense if John had said, Jesus loved Mary and Martha and Lazarus, so as soon as he got their message, he dropped everything and he ran. Or it would make sense if John said, Jesus didn't really care about Mary and Martha and Lazarus, and he was busy with other stuff, and so when their message came, he thought, you know, just low priority. But no, John says Jesus loved these siblings, and so he didn't come. In fact, he deliberately waited until Lazarus was dead, and then he came. And Martha comes out to meet him, and she says, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask of God, he will give you." Now, do you see this woman's faith? Her brother is dead and in his tomb, and she still believes that maybe Jesus can heal him. Jesus says to her, "Your brother will rise again." Now, many Jews of Jesus' day believed that there would be a final resurrection on the last day, that God's people would be raised to life. And Martha believes this as well. She says, I know, Lord, he be raised at the resurrection on the last day. But you can almost hear her disappointment. You know, what about now, Jesus? What about now? She'd sent a message to Jesus because she wanted him to come and heal Lazarus now. And Jesus says to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Anyone who believes in me, even though he dies, will live. And whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?" This is one of the famous "I am" statements in John's gospel. John is famous for recording these moments when Jesus invoked the covenant name of God from the Old Testament, the name that was so holy that God's people would not utter it, invoked that and called it down upon himself. "I am the good shepherd. I am the way, the truth, and the life." And here, "I am the resurrection and the life." most of Jesus's I am statements are spoken to groups. But here, he's speaking to one grieving woman, and he asks her individually and specifically, do you believe this? This is one of the moments in the Gospels when Jesus delivers some of his meatiest, most powerful theological teaching to a woman. And those words echo down to us through the centuries, but they were first spoken to Martha of Bethany. And we know how the story goes on. Martha goes and calls Mary. She comes out, weeps at Jesus' feet. Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. They go together to the tomb. Jesus weeps with these sisters, even though he let Lazarus die in the first place. Even though he knows he's about to raise Lazarus from the dead, Jesus weeps with these women. And then he calls their brother back to life out of the grave. We see in that chapter, both Mary and Martha as Jesus' disciples. And we see earlier in John's Gospel another example of Jesus delivering some of his most important theological teaching to a woman. In John 4, Jesus famously meets with this Samaritan woman at a well. We were talking about this last night, how in our culture today, if we know anything about Samaritans, we know they're good. But in Jesus' time and culture, if you knew anything about Samaritans, you knew they were bad. And the woman Jesus meets with at the well was not only a Samaritan and not only a woman, but also she'd had five husbands and she was now living with a man who wasn't her husband. She's the last person Jesus should have been with. Like, a respectable Jewish rabbi should not have been seen dead with a woman like this. And yet Jesus starts this conversation with her about living water. It's actually the longest private recorded conversation Jesus has with anybody in the Gospels. And it's with this disreputable Samaritan woman. And at the end of it, she says, I know that Messiah, he who is called Christ, when he comes, he will teach us all things. And Jesus says to her, I am the one speaking to you. Now, if you Google Jesus' I am statements in John's Gospel, you almost certainly won't find that one listed. And that's partly because the I am statements usually come with some massive declaration about who Jesus is. I am the true vine. I am the good shepherd. I am the light of the world. But here he's just saying, I am the one speaking to you. But actually, if you think about it, Jesus is saying something extraordinary there. What he's saying is, I am the creator God of all the universe, the one who is so holy that a human being cannot look on God and live. I am the one who chooses to spend my time with a woman nobody else would have bothered with. I am the one speaking to you. There's so much more we could say about discipleship and women in the Gospels. But for the sake of time, I'm going to move on to healing. There are many accounts in the Gospels of Jesus healing various people, male and female. Some are named, some are unnamed. So much richness in all of those accounts. And if you think about it, Jesus actually healed hundreds, perhaps even thousands of people during his public ministry. And so the gospel authors have to be very selective about which individual healing stories they tell us. And there's one story that's told, it's kind of like a double healing story. And it's told in three of the gospels. And it's the story of a situation where a man who, one of our gospel authors identifies as Jairus, a synagogue ruler, comes to Jesus, kneels down in front of him and says, Lord, my little girl, my daughter, is very sick. She's dying. Will you come? And Jesus sets off right away. But while he's on the journey, while he's on his way to heal this little girl, a woman who has been bleeding for 12 years thinks to herself, if I could just touch the hem of Jesus's garment, I know that I'd be healed. Now, what do we know about this woman? We know that she has spent all the money she had on doctors, and instead of making her better, they've only made her worse. We know that she's had this chronic bleeding condition for 12 years, and that in terms of Jewish ceremonial laws, she would have been excluded from worship for that whole time. She's not only enduring kind of physical suffering, she's also enduring social and even sort of spiritual ostracization. And she sneaks up on Jesus in the midst of this crowd, and she touches the hem of his garment, and immediately she feels that the blood has stopped. And presumably her exit strategy is she's just going to kind of melt off back into the crowd and hope that nobody noticed. But Jesus says, wait a minute, who touched me? And his disciples are like, what are you talking about? You're in the middle of a crowd. Everybody's crushing around you. What are you saying? Who touched me? Jesus says, no. I felt the power go out from me. Who touched me? And he starts looking around. He's searching for this person. And so the woman comes in front of Jesus, trembling with fear. Now, presumably, she thinks she's about to be rebuked publicly by this rabbi for making him unclean by touching him. And so she tells Jesus what she's done. And Jesus says to her, daughter, your faith has made you well. She's actually the only person in the Gospels whom Jesus addresses as daughter. Of course she has the right to touch him. She's his family. And just at that kind of happy moment, messengers come from Jairus' house to say that his daughter is dead. And Jesus says, don't be afraid, just believe. So he and Peter, James, and John go on to Jairus' house. Jesus gets rid of everybody else except for the girl's parents and his sort of inner circle of these three guys. And he goes in, and he famously says to this little girl in Aramaic, their shared mother tongue, Talitha kumi, little girl, I say to you, get up. And this little 12-year-old girl gets up, and he says to her parents, give us something to eat. Now, we see here that this little girl had been alive for as long as the woman had been bleeding. Jesus is able to heal this woman with just a touch on the hem of his garment. And he's able to call this little girl back to life. Again, it's just a glimpse of Jesus' healing ministry. There are far more stories of Jesus healing women in the Gospels, and far more stories of Jesus healing women that never made it into the Gospels that we will never hear. But Jesus spends his time specifically with these women, and the gospel authors spend their precious manuscript lines telling us about these particular stories so that we will understand quite the extent to which Jesus welcomes women. We saw Jesus as welcoming that Samaritan woman who most Jews of his day would have thought of as completely beyond the pale. And we see Jesus welcoming this woman who's been bleeding for 12 years. And communicating to her and to women ever since that Jesus is afraid of nothing female-wise. He is welcoming to women. He validates women. He loves women. He, as we've seen, shows extraordinary respect to women in how he converses with them. All too often, and I'm sure this isn't true in this church, but women's ministries and women's Bible studies will sometimes kind of damp down the theological rigor because, you know, we're talking with women, right? They're not going to want too much meat. But Jesus doesn't take that approach at all. He engages with women and he treats women with this extraordinary respect, which Again, in our culture today, it's less remarkable because we don't live in a culture which explicitly downgrades women. I actually think there are many meaningful ways in which our culture does downgrade women, but we at least don't think that that's what we're doing. And Jesus is living in a culture where that was often the case, and yet he is lifting women up and caring for them and healing them in these extraordinary ways. So prophecy, discipleship, healing. Our fourth focus is forgiveness. As I said, if you read through Luke's gospel, you'll often find men and women paralleled, and often the man doesn't come out well from the comparison. And there's a story told of when Jesus was having dinner with a Pharisee named Simon. Now, usually when we hear about the Pharisees in the Gospels, they're telling Jesus off and trying to kind of, you know, get, they're in an adversarial relationship with Jesus. But here, this Pharisee, Simon, has invited Jesus to dinner. Now, fun side note, just as Mary was the most common name for women of Jesus' time and place, Simon was by far the most common name for men. So that's why there are so many Simons in the Gospels, so many Marys in the Gospels. That's why Jesus says to Simon Peter, oh, let's call you Peter. You know, let's keep things a little clear here. So Jesus is at the house of Simon the Pharisee, and a really embarrassing thing happens. Luke tells us that a woman of the city who was a sinner comes in, and she starts weeping on Jesus' feet and washing them with her tears and wiping them with her hair and pouring ointment on them like she's basically an embarrassment. And Simon is appalled by this. And he says, if this man was a prophet, he would know what kind of woman this is, that she's a sinner. You know, Simon's implication is, if Jesus really was sent by God, he would want nothing to do with this woman. And here he is letting her touch him. What's going on? And Jesus tells Simon a story about two people who owed different amounts of money to another man, and how both of them were let off their debt. And then he says to Simon, you know, tell me, which of these two guys will love the man who forgave them their debt more? The one who was forgiven more or the one who was forgiven less debt? And Simon's like, well, I mean, I guess the one who was let off more. And then Jesus works through how Simon has treated him and how this woman of the city who was a sinner has treated him, and makes the point that yes, she's been forgiven a lot, but you know what? That means she loves Jesus a lot. And meanwhile, Simon, who thinks that he only needs a little bit of forgiveness, if any, he's pretty pleased with himself, is actually missing who Jesus is. We see Jesus, in fact, shaming this self-righteous man and holding up this woman who would have been despised as an example of faith. And we see this throughout the Gospels. People come to Jesus because they recognize their need. They're desperate for healing. They're desperate for forgiveness. They're desperate for help. The people who think they have it all together have no need for Jesus. They can't see who he is. And honestly, it's the same today. If we think we basically have it all together, we're not going to recognize our need for Jesus. And that is a desperately dangerous position to be in. Because actually, all of us are in need of the most profound forgiveness. And only some of us will recognize that, like this sinful woman of the city did, and come and pour ourselves out in Jesus' feet, receiving his forgiveness and responding to him with love. Prophecy, discipleship, healing, forgiveness, and life. As I mentioned earlier, when the gospel authors point us to individual named people, it's often because they're giving us an eyewitness. They're saying, you can go and ask this person if you want this account to be verified. And it's very interesting in the gospel accounts of the final days of Jesus' life on earth that we see women stepping into specific witnessing roles. When Jesus is crucified, we see multiple women who are named as witnesses of that event, including Mary Magdalene, including Mary, Jesus' mother. It's actually, if you go and count up the number of Marys who are named by different gospel authors as witnesses of Jesus' crucifixion, it's like, you know, I think it's at least four women named Mary who were there witnessing Jesus' crucifixion. And again, there was a large group of women, but there are certain people who are named for us by the gospel authors because they're being given to us as eyewitnesses, almost like footnotes in a book to say, here's where you can go and, you know, do further research. We see women witnessing the crucifixion, and then we see women actually witnessing Jesus' burial as well. In our community group at our church, we are working through Matthew's gospel at the moment, and just last week, we were looking at the account that Matthew gives us of Jesus' burial. And we see Joseph of Arimathea, this very respectable Jewish man, who's a member of the kind of ruling council, goes and asks for Jesus' body, takes it famously to a new tomb, and does a kind of makeshift burial, because there isn't time for the full burial rites before the Sabbath begins. But we see, you know, Joseph, very respectable man. And John tells us that actually Nicodemus, another very respectable Jewish leader, was also involved in this. Now, Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus would have been ideal witnesses to Jesus' resurrection from a first century Jewish perspective. If you were wanting to persuade as many people as possible that this crazy thing had happened, that before that resurrection on the last day that many Jews believed in, that somebody had actually been raised to life, you know, here and now, you would have wanted your most respectable witnesses. You would have wanted your Josephs of Arimathea and your Nicodemuses. And we see those two guys burying Jesus. But then, interestingly, in Matthew tells us that Mary Magdalene and the other Mary, who's Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, witnessed the burial. Now, why is Matthew telling us that? Well, because it's important that the women who knew Jesus very well, who saw him crucified, who saw which tomb he was put in, that it's actually those same women who are coming back to the tomb very early on the third day. As dawn is breaking on that Sunday morning, they're among the women who are coming with spices, with the plan of finishing off Jesus' burial. But of course, there's a problem. Because Jesus isn't there. It's these women who meet with angels who tell them that Jesus has been raised. Just as he said he would be, but just as none of the disciples seem to have really taken on board. We see these women even meeting with Jesus in person at that moment. Matthew tells us that Mary Magdalene, the other Mary, met Jesus, that they grabbed onto his feet and worshipped him. They finally like fully recognized who Jesus is. And he sends them to go and tell the male apostles what's happened. But John's account is very interesting because he actually focuses us specifically on Mary Magdalene. Now, some critics of Christianity will try to say, because there are differences between the resurrection accounts across the four Gospels, that actually this discredits the narrative. Bart Ehrman, who I was mentioning last night, who's a famous critic of Christianity in many ways, and particularly of the Gospel accounts, he says, you know, John's telling us it's all about Mary Magdalene, but actually then we see in the other Gospel accounts, we see, you know, other women named as well, so what's the deal with that? Well, actually, even within the narrative in John's Gospel, you'll notice that when Mary goes and tells, she runs to tell the male apostles about what's happened, she speaks in the plural. So John's point is not that only Mary Magdalene was there, but he is focusing us in on this one particular woman who we know has been with Jesus from the beginning of his ministry, essentially, who we know was witnessing the crucifixion and witnessing the burial who then shows up that first Sunday morning to be part of the proper burial team, as it were. And famously, when Jesus does meet with Mary, she thinks he's the gardener. You know, she's weeping and she's confused and she's distressed, and she thinks that somebody's taken her the Lord's body away, and she can't even bury him properly. And how does Jesus communicate with her in that moment? He just says her name, that incredibly common name. He says to her, Mary. And when she hears her rabbi speak her name, she recognizes him. And she goes back to the male disciples and she tells them, I have seen the Lord. Richard Borkham, again, is very interesting on this. He points out that in eyewitness accounts, verbs to do with seeing are very important. And if you read through the resurrection accounts and the accounts of the women witnessing the crucifixion, burial, and resurrection of Jesus, you'll see verbs of seeing again and again and again. And then Jesus' message to Mary that's passed on to the disciples is in her very simple statement, I have seen the Lord. Now, it's fascinating that Jesus chooses to reveal himself to the women at this point, because actually, again, from John's account, we know he could easily have revealed himself to Peter. Both Peter and the author of John's gospel, when they first hear from the women that the tomb is empty, they rush over there to see what's happening. And Jesus almost intentionally doesn't meet with them. Instead, he meets with Mary and the other women. Now, once again, it doesn't feel as significant to us as it would have done to the first readers of the Gospels. Because in our minds, women aren't unreliable witnesses compared to men. But in first century Jewish and Greco-Roman culture, women would have been seen as quite unreliable witnesses, especially when it came to religious matters. And women were seen as very emotional and prone to delusion. In fact, there's a second century Greek philosopher named Celsus who laughs at Christianity because he says, you know, Christians want and are able to attract only the foolish and uneducated, only women, slaves, and little children. And Celsus especially laughs at the idea that this weeping, like hysterical woman is supposedly the witness to Jesus' resurrection. He kind of takes a swing at Mary Magdalene in particular. But I love how in John's account, John tells us again and again that Mary is crying. He is completely unashamed of the fact that this woman is weeping her guts out. And it's this very emotional, distraught woman who Jesus reveals himself to and who is entrusted with that message back to the other disciples. I have seen the Lord. And what happens after that? Well, in the last 2,000 years, as far as we can tell, from all sort of historical resources and evidence, there have actually always been more Christian women than men. As I mentioned, in the second century, Christianity was being laughed at as a religion of women. But even today, if you look around the world, not only in America, but actually across the world, you'll find that there are more Christian women than men. I mentioned last night that rather than shrinking globally, Christianity is actually growing. And one of the big reasons for this is what's happening in China. So China right now is the global center of atheism. But experts think that very shortly there'll be more Christians in China than in America. And there's at least one leading expert of sociology of religion in China, a man named Fengeng Yang, who's at Purdue University, who thinks that China could be a majority Christian country by 2060. But if you look at the demographics of the church in China, you'll find that it's disproportionately female. Now, why is this? We don't have any, like, strong theological arguments as to why this should be the case. But I think we do have plenty of evidence in the scriptures that the Lord in particular reveals himself to those who are less high status. He typically, in particular, reveals himself to the poor and to the marginalized. And globally and historically, it's fair to say that women have tended to have less power than men. So if we go back to Mary's extraordinary message about who Jesus is and what God is doing as he sends his son into the world, of overturning the power structures of this world, it's not actually completely surprising that there would be more Christian women than men. Perhaps there is more of a sense among women globally of their desperate need, more of a sense of weakness and vulnerability. And we need to recognize our need if we're going to come to Jesus. So those are the five things I'd encourage you to just sort of keep an eye out for in the Gospels when it comes to women: prophecy, discipleship, healing, forgiveness, and life. And just as a last momentary reflection, because the book I wrote is very specifically confined to the Gospels, and it's looking, as I say, in particular, at just, you know, what do we see of Jesus' relationship with women in the Gospels? And the Gospels don't actually answer for us questions around what role women should, specific roles women should play in church. There are a lot of questions that the Gospels aren't aiming to answer for us. And in the rest of the New Testament, there's actually, you know, more text that we can look at to help us just sort of think through some of these questions. And there are theologians who I respect who actually draw different conclusions about exactly what role women should and shouldn't play in churches. But one thing I think it's very important for us all to recognize, even as we come into those conversations, we need to make sure that we are not making the mistake that Jesus' first disciples made time and time again, and that Jesus had to correct them about time and time again. Because often we frame the conversation like this. We say, men get to be pastors, which is a position of power and authority, and it's really unfair on women if they don't get to have that kind of privilege as well. That is an incredibly poor theological argument. Jesus said to his disciples time and again that leadership in his kingdom is not about power and privilege, but about sacrifice and service. You know, he said to them, even the Son of Man, even Jesus himself, the great king sent by the God of all the universe, did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. None of us in this room, male or female, should be aspiring to sort of leadership in ministry because we are seeking power or privilege. And the reality is all of us will be tempted toward that. And people sometimes say, well, it can't be the right theological conclusion that only men should be taking pastor roles, because then you're completely discrediting the ministry of women. And I'd want to say, actually, I think that's theologically unjustifiable, because the gospel evangelistic Bible teaching serving ministry of women and men that can be done without any formal sort of title within the church or role in a leadership structure is actually the most important gospel work that goes on in any church. So again, I'm not seeking to sort of answer any big questions there, but just to say, let's make sure as we think about these questions theologically for ourselves, that we're doing so on Jesus' terms and not with an actually kind of worldly understanding of what authority means among God's people.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.